Chapter 5. Diverting a few pennies from their wickedness to the Lord's service. She shook the box again, and I dropped a dime into it. In front of a glittering hotel, a friend of mine, a critic, was climbing from a cab. He seemed at leisure, and I put my question to him. He answered me conscientiously, as I was sure he would. "There is a type of man about town in New York," he answered. "The term is quite familiar to me, but I don't think I was ever called upon to define the character before. It would be difficult to point you out an exact specimen. I would say, offhand, that it is a man who had a hopeless case of the peculiar New York disease of wanting to see and know. At 6 o'clock each day life begins with him. He follows rigidly the conventions of dress and manners, but in the business of poking his nose into places where he does not belong he could give pointers to a civet cat or a jackdaw. He is the man who has chased Bohemia about the town from Rathskeller to Roof Garden, and from Hester Street to Harlem until you can't find a place in the city where they don't cut their spaghetti with a knife. Your man about town has done that. He is always on the scent of something new. He is curiosity, impudence, and omnipresence. Hansoms were made for him, and gold banded cigars, and the curse of music at dinner. There are not so many of him, but his minority report is adopted everywhere. I'm glad you brought up the subject. I felt the influence of this nocturnal blight upon our city, but I never thought to analyze it before. I can see now that your man about town should have been classified long ago. In his wake spring up wine agents and cloak models, and the orchestra P1As lets all go up to Mods for him, by request, instead of Handel. He makes his rounds every evening, while you and I see the elephant once a week. When the cigar store is raided, he winks at the officer, familiar with his ground, and walks away immune, while you and I search among the presidents for names, and among the stars for addresses, to give the desk sergeant. My friend, the critic, paused to acquire breath for fresh eloquence. I seized my advantage. "You have classified him," I cried with joy. "You have painted his portrait in the gallery of city types. But I must meet one face to face. I must study the man about town at first hand. Where shall I find him? How shall I know him?" Without seeming to hear me, the critic went on. "And his cab driver was waiting for his fare too. He is the sublimated essence of butt-in, the refined intrinsic extract of rubber, the concentrated, purified, irrefutable unavoidable spirit of curiosity and inquisitiveness. A new sensation is the breath in his nostrils. When his experience is exhausted he explores new fields with the indefatigability of a..." "Excuse me," I interrupted, "but can you produce one of this type? It is a new thing to me. I must study it. I will search the town over until I find one. Its habitat must be here on Broadway." "I am about to dine here," said my friend. "Come inside, and if there is a man about town present I will point him out to you. I know most of the regular patrons here." "I am not dining yet," I said to him. "Who will excuse me? I am going to find my man about town this night, if I have to rake New York from the Battery to Little Coney Island." I left the hotel and walked down Broadway. The pursuit of my type gave a pleasant savor of life and interest to the air I breathed. I was glad to be in a city so great, so complex and diversified. Leisurely and with something of an air I strolled along with my heart expanding at the thought that I was a citizen of Great Gotham, a sharer in its magnificence and pleasures, a partaker in its glory and prestige. I turned to cross the street. I heard something buzz like a bee, and then I took a long, pleasant ride with Santos Dumont. When I opened my eyes I remembered a smell of gasoline, and I said aloud, "Hasn't it passed yet?" A hospital nurse laid a hand that was not particularly soft upon my brow, that was not at all fevered. A young doctor came along, grinned, and handed me a morning newspaper. "Want to see how it happened?" he asked cheerily. I read the article. Its headlines began where I heard the buzzing leave off the night before. It closed with these lines. Bellevue Hospital, where it was said that his injuries were not serious. He appeared to be a typica one man about town. The cop and the anthem on his bench in Madison Square Soapy moved uneasily. When wild geese honk high of nights, and when women without sealskin coats grow kind to their husbands, and when Soapy moves uneasily on his bench in the park, you may know that winter is near at hand. A dead leaf fell in Soapy's lap. That was Jack Frost's card. Jack is kind to the regular denizens of Madison Square, and gives fair warning of his annual call. At the corners of four streets he hands his pasteboard to the north wind, footman of the mansion of all outdoors, so that the inhabitants thereof may make ready. Soapy's mind became cognizant of the fact that the time had come for him to resolve himself into a singular committee of ways and means to provide against the coming rigor, and therefore he moved uneasily on his bench. The hibernatorial ambitions of Soapy were not of the highest. In them there were no considerations of Mediterranean cruises, of soporific southern skies drifting in the Vesuvian Bay. 3 months on the isle, and was what his soul craved. 3 months of assured board and bed and congenial company, safe from boreas and bluecoats, seemed to Soapy the essence of things desirable. For years the hospitable Blackwells had been his winter quarters. Just as his more fortunate fellow New Yorkers had bought their tickets to Palm Beach and the Riviera each winter, so Soapy had made his humble arrangements for his annual hegira to the island. And now the time was come. On the previous night, three Sabbath newspapers, distributed beneath his coat, about his ankles, and over his lap, had failed to repulse the cold as he slept on his bench near the spurting fountain in the ancient square. So the island loomed big and timely in Soapy's mind. He scorned the provisions made in the name of charity for the city's dependents. In Soapy's opinion, the law was more benign than philanthropy. There was an endless round of institutions, municipal and eleemosynary, on which he might set out and receive lodging and food accordant with the simple life. But to one of Soapy's proud spirit the gifts of charity are encumbered. If not in coin, you must pay in humiliation of spirit for every benefit received at the hands of philanthropy. As Caesar had his Brutus, every bed of charity must have its toll of a bath, every loaf of bread its compensation of a private and personal inquisition. Wherefore it is better to be a guest of the law, which though conducted by rules, does not meddle unduly with a gentleman's private affairs. Soapy, having decided to go to the island, at once set about accomplishing his desire. There were many easy ways of doing this. The pleasantest was to dine luxuriously at some expensive restaurant, and then, after declaring insolvency, be handed over quietly and without uproar to a policeman. An accommodating magistrate would do the rest. Soapy left his bench and strolled out of the square, and across the level sea of asphalt, where Broadway and Fifth Avenue flow together. Up Broadway he turned, and halted at a glittering café, where are gathered together nightly the choicest products of the grape, the silkworm and the protoplasm. Soapy had confidence in himself from the lowest button of his vest upward. He was shaven, and his coat was decent, and his neat black, ready-tied four-in-hand had been presented to him by a lady missionary on Thanksgiving Day. If he could reach a table in the restaurant unsuspected, success would be his. The portion of him that would show above the table would raise no doubt in the waiter's mind. A roasted mallard duck, thought Soapy, would be about the thing with a bottle of Chablis, and then commembered, a demi-tasse and a cigar. $1 for the cigar would be enough. The total would not be so high as to call forth any supreme manifestation of revenge from the cafe management, and yet the meat would leave him filled and happy for the journey to his winter refuge. But as Soapy set foot inside the restaurant door, the head waiter's eye fell upon his frayed trousers and decadent shoes. Strong and ready hands turned them about, and conveyed them in silence and haste to the sidewalk, and averted the ignoble fate of the menaced mallard. Soapy turned off Broadway. It seemed that his route to the coveted isle, and was not to be an Epicurean one. Some other way of entering limbo must be thought of. At a corner of 6th Avenue electric lights, and cunningly displayed wares behind plate glass made a shop window conspicuous. Soapy took a cobblestone, and dashed it through the glass. People came running around the corner, a policeman in the lead. Soapy stood still, with his hands in his pockets, and smiled at the sight of brass buttons. "Where's the man that done that?" inquired the officer excitedly. "Don't you figure out that I might have had something to do with it?" said Soapy, not without sarcasm, but friendly, as one greets good fortune. The policeman's mind refused to accept Soapy even as a clue. Men who smash windows do not remain to parley with the law's minions. They take to their heels. The policeman saw a man halfway down the block running to catch a car. With drawn club he joined in the pursuit. Soapy, with disgust in his heart, loafed along, twice unsuccessful. On the opposite side of the street was a restaurant of no great pretensions. It catered to large appetites and modest purses. Its crockery and atmosphere were thick, its soup and napery thin. Into this place Soapy took his Achis of shoes and telltale trousers without challenge. At a table he sat and consumed beefsteak, flapjacks, donuts and pie. And then to the waiter, he betrayed the fact that the minutes coin and himself were strangers. "Now, get busy and call a cop," said Soapy. "And he don't keep a gentleman waiting." "No cop for yous," said the waiter, with a voice like butter cakes, "and I like the cherry in a Manhattan cocktail. H.A. Con." Neatly upon his left ear on the callous pavement two waiters pitched Soapy. He arose, joint by joint, as a carpenter's rule opens, and beat the dust from his clothes. Arrest seemed but a rosy dream. The island seemed very far away. A policeman who stood before a drugstore two doors away laughed and walked down the street. 5 blocks Soapy traveled before his courage permitted him to woo capture again. This time the opportunity presented what he fatuously termed to himself a inch. A young woman of a modest and pleasing guise was standing before a show window gazing with sprightly interest at its display of shaving mugs and inkstands, and 2 yards from the window a large policeman of severe demeanor leaned against a water plug. It was Soapy's design to assume the role of the despicable and execrated Asher. The refined and elegant appearance of his victim, and the contiguity of the conscientious cop encouraged him to believe that he would soon feel the pleasant official clutch upon his arm that would ensure his winter quarters on the right little, tight little aisle. Soapy straightened the lady missionary's readymade tie, dragged his shrinking cuffs into the open, set his hat at a killing cant, and sidled toward the young woman. He made eyes at her, was taken with sudden coughs and ems, smiled, smirked and went brazenly through the impudent and contemptible litany of the Asher. With half an eye Soapy saw that the policeman was watching him fixedly. The young woman moved away a few steps, and again bestowed her absorbed attention upon the shaving mugs. Soapy followed, boldly stepping to her side, raised his hat and said, "Ah there, Bedelia. Don't you want to come and play in my yard?" The policeman was still looking. The persecuted young woman had but to beckon a finger, and Soapy would be practically en route for his insular haven. Already he imagined he could feel the cozy warmth of the station house. The young woman faced him, and, stretching out a hand, caught Soapy's coat sleeve. "Sure, Mike," she said joyfully, "if you'll blow me to a pail of suds. I'd have spoke to you sooner, but the cop was watching." With the young woman playing the clinging ivy to his oak, Soapy walked past the policeman overcome with gloom. He seemed doomed to liberty. At the next corner he shook off his companion and ran. He halted in the district where by night are found the lightest streets, hearts, vows and librettos. Women in furs and men in greatcoats moved gaily in the wintry air. A sudden fear seized Soapy that some dreadful enchantment had rendered him immune to arrest. The thought brought a little of panic upon it, and when he came upon another policeman lounging grandly in front of a transplendent theater, he caught at the immediate straw of disorderly conduct. On the sidewalk, Soapy began to yell drunken gibberish at the top of his harsh voice. He danced, howled, raved, and otherwise disturbed the welkin. The policeman twirled his club, turned his back to Soapy, and remarked to a citizen, "'Tis one of them Yale lads celebrating the goose egg they give to the Hartford College. Noisy, but no harm. We've instructions to lave them be." Disconsolate, Soapy ceased his unavailing racket. Would never a policeman lay hands on him? In his fancy, the island seemed an unattainable Arcadia. He buttoned his thin coat against the chilling wind. In a cigar store, he saw a well-dressed man lighting a cigar at a swinging light. His silk umbrella he had set by the door on entering. Soapy stepped inside, secured the umbrella, and sauntered off with it slowly. The man at the cigar light followed hastily. "My umbrella," he said, sternly. "Oh, is it?" sneered Soapy, adding insult to petty larceny. "L, why don't you call a policeman?" "I took it." "Your umbrella?" "Why don't you call a cop? There stands one on the corner." The umbrella owner slowed his steps. Soapy did likewise, with a presentiment that luck would again run against him. The policeman looked at the two curiously. "Of course," said the umbrella man, "had as well. You know how these mistakes occur. If it's your umbrella, I hope you'll excuse me. I picked it up this morning in a restaurant. If you recognize it as yours, why I hope you'll—" "Of course it's mine," said Soapy, viciously. The ex-umbrella man retreated. The policeman hurried to assist a tall blonde in an opera cloak across the street in front of a streetcar that was approaching two blocks away. Soapy walked eastward through a street damaged by improvements. He hurled the umbrella wrathfully into an excavation. He muttered against the men who wear helmets and carry clubs. Because he wanted to fall into their clutches, they seemed to regard him as a king who could do no wrong. At length Soapy reached one of the avenues to the east, where the glitter and turmoil was but faint. He set his face down this toward Madison Square, for the homing instinct survives, even when the home is a park bench. But on an unusually quiet corner Soapy came to a standstill. Here was an old church, quaint and rambling and gabled. Through one violet-stained window a soft light glowed, where, no doubt, the organist loitered over the keys, making sure of his mastery of the coming Sabbath anthem. For there drifted out to Soapy's ear sweet music that caught and held him transfixed against the convolutions of the iron fence. The moon was above, lustrous and serene. Vehicles and pedestrians were few. Sparrows twittered sleepily in the eaves for a little while. The scene might have been a country churchyard. And the anthem that the organist played cemented Soapy to the iron fence, for he had known it well in the days when his life contained such things as mothers, and roses and ambitions and friends and immaculate thoughts and collars. The conjunction of Soapy's receptive state of mind and the influences about the old church brought a sudden and wonderful change in his soul. He viewed with swift horror the pit into which he had tumbled, the degraded days, unworthy desires, dead hopes, wrecked faculties and base motives that made up his existence. And also in a moment his heart responded thrillingly to this novel mood. An instantaneous and strong impulse moved him to battle with his desperate fate. He would pull himself out of the mire. He would make a man of himself again. He would conquer the evil that had taken possession of him. There was time. He was comparatively young yet. He would resurrect his old eager ambitions and pursue them without faltering. Those solemn but sweet organ notes had set up a revolution in him. Tomorrow he would go into the roaring downtown district and find work. A fur importer had once offered him a place as driver. He would find him tomorrow and ask for the position. He would be somebody in the world. He would, Soapy felt a hand laid on his arm. He looked quickly around into the broad face of a policeman. "What are you doing here?" asked the officer. "Nothing," said Soapy. "Then come along," said the policeman. 3 months on the island, said the magistrate in the police court the next morning. An adjustment of nature in an art exhibition. The other day I saw a painting that had been sold for $5,000. The painter was a young scrub out of the West named Kraft, who had a favorite food and a pet theory. His pabulum was an unquenchable belief in the unerring artistic adjustment of nature. His theory was fixed around corned beef hash with poached egg. There was a story behind the picture, so I went home and let it drip out of a fountain pen. The idea of Kraft, but that is not the beginning of the story. 3 years ago Kraft, Bill Judkins, a poet, and I took our meals at Cypher's on 8th Avenue. I say ook. When we had money, Cypher got it FF of us, as he expressed it. We had no credit. We went in, called for food and ate it. We paid or we did not pay. We had confidence in Cypher's sullenness and smoldering ferocity. Deep down in his sunless soul he was either a prince, a fool or an artist. He sat at a worm-eaten desk, covered with files of waiter's checks so old that I was sure the bottomest one was for clams that Hendrik Hudson had eaten and paid for. Cypher had the power, in common with Napoleon III. And the goggle-eyed perch, of throwing a film over his eyes, rendering opaque the windows of his soul. Once when we left him unpaid, with egregious excuses, I looked back, and saw him shaking with inaudible laughter behind his film. Now and then we paid up back scores. But the chief thing at Cypher's was Millie. Millie was a waitress. She was a grand example of Kraft's theory of the artistic adjustment of nature. She belonged, largely, to waiting, as Minerva did to the art of scrapping, or Venus to the science of serious flirtation. Pedestaled and in bronze she might have stood with the noblest of her heroic sisters as Ivor and Bacon enlivening the world. She belonged to Cypher's. You expected to see her colossal figure loom through that reeking blue cloud of smoke from frying fat just as you expect the Palisades to appear through a drifting Hudson River fog. There amid the steam of vegetables, and the vapors of acres of ham, and the crash of crockery, the clatter of steel, the screaming of short orders, the cries of the hungering, and all the horrid tumult of feeding man, surrounded by swarms of the buzzing winged beasts bequeathed us by Pharaoh, Millie steered her magnificent way like some great liner cleaving among the canoes of howling savages. Our goddess of grub was built on lines so majestic that they could be followed only with awe. Her sleeves were always rolled above her elbows. She could have taken us three musketeers in her two hands and dropped us out of the window. She had seen fewer years than any of us, but she was of such superb evehood and simplicity that she mothered us from the beginning. Cypher's store of eatables she poured out upon us with royal indifference to price and quantity, as from a cornucopia that knew no exhaustion. Her voice rang like a great silver bell, her smile was many-toothed and frequent, she seemed like a yellow sunrise on mountaintops. I never saw her, but I thought of the Yosemite. And yet, somehow, I could never think of her as existing outside of Cypher's. There nature had placed her, and as he had taken root and grown mightily. She seemed happy, and took her few poor dollars on Saturday nights with the flushed pleasure of a child that receives an unexpected donation. It was Kraft who first voiced the fear that each of us must have held latently. It came up apropos, of course, of certain questions of art at which we were hammering. One of us compared the harmony existing between a Haydn symphony and pistache ice cream to the exquisite congruity between Millie and Cypher's. There is a certain fate hanging over Millie, said Kraft, and if it overtakes her, she is lost to Cypher's and to us. She will grow fat? Asked Judkins, fearsomely. She will go to night school and become refined? I ventured anxiously. It is this, said Kraft, punctuating in a puddle of spilled coffee with a stiff forefinger. Easter had as Brutus the cotton as its bollyworm, the chorus girl as her Pittsburgher, the summer boarder as his poison ivy, the hero as his Carnegie medal, art as its Morgan, the rose as its speak. I interrupted, much perturbed. Who do not think that Millie will begin to lace? One day, concluded Kraft, solemnly, there will come to Cyphers for a plate of beans a millionaire lumberman from Wisconsin, and he will marry Millie. Never! Exclaimed Judkins and T, in horror. A lumberman, repeated Kraft, hoarsely. And a millionaire lumberman. I sighed, despairingly. From Wisconsin, groaned Judkins. We agreed that the awful fate seemed to menace her. Few things were less improbable. Millie, like some vast virgin stretch of pine woods, was made to catch the lumberman's eye. And well we knew the habits of the badgers, once fortune smiled upon them. Straight to New York they hie, and lay their goods at the feet of the girl who serves them beans in a beanery. Why, the alphabet itself connives. The Sunday newspaper's headliner's work is cut for him. Winsome waitress wins wealthy Wisconsin woodsman. For a while we felt that Millie was on the verge of being lost to us. It was our love of the unerring artistic adjustment of nature that inspired us. We could not give her over to a lumberman, doubly accursed by wealth and provincialism. We shuddered to think of Millie, with her voice modulated and her elbows covered, pouring tea in the marble teepee of a tree murderer. No. In Cyphers she belonged in the bacon smoke, the cabbage perfume, the grand, Wagnerian chorus of hurled ironstone china and rattling casters. Our fears must have been prophetic, for on that same evening the Wildwood discharged upon us Millie's preordained confiscator our fee to adjustment and order. But Alaska and not Wisconsin bore the burden of the visitation. We were at our supper of beef stew, and dried apples when he trotted in, as if on the heels of a dog team, and made one of the mess at our table. With the freedom of the camps he assaulted our ears, and claimed the fellowship of men lost in the wilds of a hash house. We embraced him as a specimen, and in 3 minutes we had all but died for one another as friends. He was rugged, and bearded and wind-dried. He had just come off the trail, he said, at one of the North River ferries. I fancied I could see the snow dust of Chilkoot yet powdering his shoulders. And then he strewed the table with the nuggets, stuffed ptarmigans, beadwork and seal pelts of the returned Keondicker, and began to prate to us of his millions. Bank drafts for 2 millions, was his summing up, and 1,000 a day piling up from my claims. And now I want some beef stew and Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.